Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, yes, yes. This is another episode of Wake Up African People, and this is the Truth Doctor. And tonight, we have two guests, along with our esteemed panel of Sister Yemoja, Brother B, and Astro Ra. And we're supposed to have the international organizer of the UNIA, Brother Muammar Kamal, and also Brother Cimarron from the Marcus Garvey Society tonight to break down the difference between Pan-Africanism and African Redemptionism, I like to call it. They may call it something else, but Garvey used that name, Redemption, so much it's stuck in my head, to redeem, to take back. So tonight, we are going to show you that it's a difference. And anybody that's running around saying that they're Garveyite and a Pan-Africanist, I don't understand that. So, Astro Ra, the mic is yours.
Good evening, brothers and sisters. Stay strong, stay black. On the topic of Pan-Africanism, Pan-African Congress of 1919. The 1919 Pan-African Congress was held in Paris to coincide with the Paris Peace Conference ending World War I. It was held to develop a plan for a lasting peace between the European states and the United States of America after the devastation of World War I. Africans and African descended activists tried to influence the political agenda of the Paris Peace Conference as it related to the political and economic location of all African and Caribbean colonies, as well as the African descended peoples of the Americas. The Allied powers did not encourage such organization because the rebuilding of the international economy depended upon the continued control and exploitation of all of their colonies, including Africa and its people. As a result, very few marginalized groups from Asia and Africa were able to negotiate or meet with Allied powers during the conference. Given these obstacles, it is impressive that the Pan-African Congress came to fruition and eventually presented resolutions to the new League of Nations. The United States government refused to issue passports to W.E.B. Du Bois to navigate around the obstacles and organize the Pan-African Congress in Paris in February of 1919. Dignan's role was crucial to the convening of the conference. A Senegalese, Diagne, who was the highest-ranking African in French politics, having assisted in France in recruiting African soldiers. As a Senegalese deputy to the French Parliament, the French Prime Minister approved the Congress. Nevertheless, he disapproved widespread publicity for it. Du Bois was instrumental in assembling delegates from various African, American, and European organizations. There were at least 57 delegates representing 15 countries and colonies, including Haiti, Liberia, the British West Indies, West African colonies, and the United States. At least 19 delegates from America and Africa. Although it is often referred to as the first Pan-African Congress, it actually was actually patterned after the Pan-African Conference, convening in 1900 by Henry Sylvester Williams. Du Bois had been a delegate at the 1900 conference. The Congress petitioned allied nations to take specific actions to address oppressive political and economic conditions prevailing throughout predominantly black colonies and throughout the Americas. The Congress requested numerous changes to the colonial policy, including the following criteria, critical areas: land ownership and equitable economic development, which would allow Africans to profit from the sale of their natural resources. They also wanted a portion of European profit to be committed to the economic development of those colonies. Two, the educational opportunity and accessible health care were highlighted to ensure that Africans would acquire effective knowledge to compete in the international economy. The delegates lobbied for educational programming, not only in the industrial fields, but also in language and Western governance. Healthcare was considered a vital component of effective development as well. Three, African participation in local government and the decolonization of the mandated colonies were primary concerns. The delegates were concerned about the plight of African colonies that defeated Germany had to relinquish. The PAC delegates called for the League of Nations to administer these so-called mandated colonies, ensuring that the European powers could not absorb them, and also make it possible for the diaspora Africans to migrate and settle within these mandated areas. The Congress participated in envisionment and the establishment of a bureau within the League to develop and implement these resolutions. Though Du Bois did get the opportunity to discuss these resolutions with the U.S. officials, over 1,000 copies of the resolution were distributed. No delegates were authorized to address the peace conference, and ultimately the resolutions were not instituted. Undeterred, the Pan-African Congress delegates established an executive committee toward the development of a worldwide body to lobby for these goals, and they agree to hold Congress biannually. The next Congress was to meet in 1921.
Okay, is that it?
That's
okay.
It.
Now, we want Brother Cimarron to talk about the difference between that and the Garvey movement. And you notice that Marcus Garvey's name wasn't mentioned, and he was around at that time in 1921. I mean, he was doing his thing. I mean, his organization was the biggest that ever was to this very day. And we want to show the difference between these two ideologies. And we want to talk about the effects that happened out of both of them. Which one was more effective in starting Africa in the world? Brother Cimarron? The mic is yours.
All right. As always, I definitely appreciate you for having me on the show. I want to, thank those who are on the show as well. I think before we really get into the nuts and bolts of Pan-Africanism or African redemption, you know, the very first thing that you have to do is deal with the personality of the individuals who coined these phrases. Now, Pan-Africanism or Pan-African was not necessarily coined by Henry Sylvester Williams. And this is a brother who was out of Trinidad. It was a term that had been used, but through the conference, the actual conference that he had hosted over in Europe, it took off. And, of course, now in the 21st century, you know, this is something that you know, is, I don't want to say loosely used, but, you know, is used to identify those who are a part of a particular struggle or movement. Now, the word itself, you know, pan is just a Greek word which means all. So it just really pretty much means all African, just like if you were addressing the AARP, All African Revolutionary People's Party. But his idea or the construct of Pan-Africanism is not necessarily a brand in which I think that we as African people, you know, need to adopt. When Brother was going over just the information, just the general information, as you could see in terms of the aims and objects, it was not necessarily an overthrow of colonialism, but it was more so of an for permission in doing various things related to the continent of Africa. And then it also did not have a broader program dealing with Africans outside of the continent of Africa. So it was almost as if they were saying that there were certain freedoms or liberties that they had outside of Africa, and they just wanted those on the continent of Africa to be able to share in the same things that they were given, whether it was under British rule or whether it was under American rule. So when we look at Henry Sylvester Williams, the first thing that we have to do is we have to look at his background in particular. Here's a black man, you know, from the Caribbean, from Trinidad, who studied, in England, and eventually marries a European, a white woman. And so the father of this woman, you know, is strictly opposed to their marriage. So it tells you where his mindset was at that particular point in time, that period. We're talking 1900, you know. One of the very first things that he did was reached out to Booker T. Washington, and he had asked if Booker T. Washington would endorse this actual conference as well as be one of the conveners. He wanted Booker T. Washington to be a part of the actual conference over in Europe. But because Booker T. Washington was already in Europe at that time and was about to come back to the States, what he did was he just pretty much issued a statement of support. And in his support, Prince, he asked that others participate as well. Now, of course, you know, all of us know that Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois were great rivals, and I think that this is one of the reasons why Booker T. Washington did not actually participate in the Pan-African Conference. Now, this does not necessarily dub or make Booker T. Washington a Pan-African, but he did have certain sentiments towards this particular movement because, as you know, in parts of Africa, he actually had students on the ground who was helping to cultivate the land in various regions, pretty much in German territory at that particular time. And, you know, from cotton to you name it, he was dealing with, you know, various things. He was also vocal about the Congo at that time and what was going on, with Leopold and how, the people were being treated and the dismemberment of African people as well. And so that's one of the things that's never really talked about or discussed. But going back to this whole concept of how it actually got started, that is the beginning or the origins of the conference being held abroad. Now, some would argue the point and say that Pan-Africanism or African redemption started far earlier than that with the conferences that were being held in the States, places like Cleveland, upstate New York, and Canada. And I guess you would say that the Trinity would be Martin Delaney, Henry Highland Garnett, and Alexander Crummell. And the reason why I didn't mention Bishop Henry McNeil Turner at this point is because he comes on the scene a little bit later. But these individuals are pretty much the central figures of what we consider or classify as black nationalism, something that Mr. Garvey would not usher in, but really bring more of a formal idea of black nationalism to black people. And in these conferences, they would discuss issues centered around Africa and acquiring land. They would speak to the issue of how to overthrow chattel slavery in the South. In fact, one of the greatest debates that ever took place was between Henry Highland Garnett and Frederick Douglass. Frederick Douglass opposed black people going into the South and taking up weapons and fighting the free African people, whereas Henry Highland Garnett, now you have to be mindful, Henry Highland Garnett was an amputee. One of his legs was amputated some years, you know, due to an injury that he had. And he gave a fiery speech in relation to nationalism, nationhood, why we should achieve it, and why we should come together and crush the institution of slavery, of chattel slavery, in the South. And it was put to a vote, and he lost by one vote. And so, of course, today, you know, we still have the nationalist community and the civil rights community. So these men were very instrumental, you know, at this particular time. This is not to take away from, you know, the Julia Coopers and many of the others who participated in the conference in Europe, but its objective was not to overthrow the institution of white supremacy. Those who came before them were about destroying, demolishing the institution of white supremacy. And that's what, and I think that's what you're speaking to, Akbar, is African redemption. But as Marcus Garvey coins it and puts it in the course of African philosophy, he said that black nationalism, you know, should basically be, it should be the culmination of everything on the continent. It should end in the culmination of everything on the continent of Africa, and that is to build a nation. And so what he uses is, he uses Negro nationalism, but of course in parentheses, Dr. Tony Martin has it as black nationalism. And that's pretty much what was used at that time. Now, when you look at the aims and objects of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, and the very first thing that he talks about is pride, self-pride, pride and race. That's the very first objective in itself. Not to, I always like to use the example of, you know, just about any sport, you know, there always has to be a winner, you know. Even in a race, you know, they'll do a photo finish before they say that it's a tie, you know. Same for basketball, football, baseball. You know, it's not going to be a tie. Someone has to win. So, you know, you don't run alongside of your opponent to say that you want to be equal and you want to share the trophy together. You know, someone has to win. So this was what Marcus Garvey was talking about. He was talking about a black supremacy, not supremacy in the context of ruling or lording over any group of people on this planet, but to be supreme in all of our ideas and what it is that we do and what it is that we contribute to the world. And that was supposed to be, a development on the continent of Africa. Then it would, you know, pretty much stretch abroad to the rest of the world. So when you look at the Declaration of Rights, which was, you know, implemented and instituted August 13, 1920, when you go through all 54, you see what the wants and the needs of the people are. And this is what really defines what black nationalism is.
Brother Cimarron, let me stop you for a minute. Can everybody mute a phone because of some disturbance in the background? Just mute your phone until I call you. Please. Proceed, my brother.
Yeah, so, you know, this is the difference between a Pan-African movement as well as a black nationalist movement. Now, the Pan-African movement caught on more so because, again, you know, Mr. Garvey, who made his transition in 1940, and then you have Du Bois, you know, who makes his transition, I believe, 63. You know, this is either the day before or the actual day of the March on Washington, you know, when he makes his transition. Of course, Kwame Nkrumah, he is in power at this time. in Ghana, which was formerly, you know, noted as the Gold Coast. He himself, you know, married outside of the race. You know, some say the woman was an Arab, but she looked more European than she actually looks Arab. And you see this with some of the other leaders, you know, up on the continent at that particular time. And so you see that communism enters into this brand of Pan-Africanism, and this is something that Du Bois had accepted as well. There was no actual program, and of course, you know, Du Bois was kicked out of the NAACP in 1934, if I stand correct. 1934, he was put out of the organization, although he started to come to the idea that Marcus Garvey was correct, because he realized that the NAACP never truly had a program designed for black people. And so they took the Crisis magazine away from him. They ousted him outside of the organization. And, you know, he had some issues later on being outside of that organ, that organization. And so, you know, he elects to be with different ones on the continent who are studying in Europe, and the George Padmores and the C.L.R. James and many of the others. He winds up becoming more of, I guess you would say, in a sense, not necessarily a lackey, but a symbol of what they deem a dub Pan-Africanism. He didn't really play a key role in those conferences, but he held the chair because of his age and because of the fact that it started with him and Henry Sylvester Williams. When Henry, you know, with Henry Sylvester Williams, after the first conference, what you find is that, you know, after the conference is over, the program is no longer an international call, but it becomes a domestic issue there in Europe that he's fighting for. So I don't think he was necessarily clear in what it was that he was really trying to achieve, but it would be these latter-day Pan-Africanists who would reap the benefits and the rewards of, you know, the struggle on the continent. And of course, you know, this is why, you know, African Liberation Day is so strong. Although Mr. Garvey had a greater influence on their thoughts related to keeping everything African. And I don't know if you want to, you know, go into any questions or comments at this time, but, you know, we can opt to do that if you'd like. And if Brother Morimah is on, you know, he can speak to it as well.
Yeah. He's coming on now, having a little difficulty. I'm going to bring him on in a minute. But I want to ask you this question. I'm going to pass off to Sister Moja before she leaves. But I want to ask you this. I want you to answer this question here.
Yes,
a lot of people understand that Joel Spingard was at the conference, the Jew, you know, was he, you know what he was. I want to let you say everything that he was and everything he was about. And I want
you to
explain his participation.
Yeah, well, I mean, Spingard was more of a puppeteer to Du Bois and the NAACP. I mean, you know, here's a man who was, you know, able to sway Du Bois in the direction that, you know, he saw fit. Initially, Du Bois was opposed to black men fighting in World War One, and you know, when Spingard, you know, pretty much produced some funds and said that, you know, I think that it would be, you know, better for black men to in World War One. So did Du Bois's tune change. And I mean, you know, that's always been the issue. You know, we don't even have to go back that far. I mean, we can go back to the 90s of when, you know, Ben Chavis was told by, you know, the Jews to not invite or uninvite Minister Farrakhan to their anniversary celebration. So, you know, that's all. That's always been key. That's always been, and it's always been about that dollar. Now, in terms of him actually being at the conference, I can't say, but I would not be surprised if he was.
Sister Yemoja, the mic is yours for your questions. Sister Yemoja, are you with us? Now, Brother B, mic is yours. Brother Bob.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, the mic.
Okay. What impact do the Pan-African movement have on our situation today?
Well, I mean, you know, I think you have a lot of organizations that profess, you know, that they are Pan-African in spirit, but I don't necessarily think that it's, you know, that much indeed. We really don't see much activity going on like we once, you know, initially saw with, you know, Maurice Bishop of Grenada, with the New Jewel Movement, you know, the Samora Michelles, you know, Thomas Sankara. We don't see a lot of those movements or activities going on. I think the closest that we see on the continent, I'll say, is Brother Malema down in South Africa. Of course, you know, one of the newest political states that's been developed is Southern Sudan. And, you know, it's not a very strong nation. We don't see that connection that we once had when, you know, South Africa was under apartheid. And so, you know, the Alumbe Brafts and, you know, many of the others have, you know, kind of made their transition. They were pretty much the window or the telescope for all of us to see what was going on abroad. We have, again, like I say, organizations that exist, but the connection is not as strong as it should be. But then again, you know, we have to redefine, you know, what is Pan-Africanism? You know, is it all inclusive of everyone? Meaning that because you have a broader scope of how black people are today, you know, we're not the same people of Mr. Garvey's era. It's a different type, a different brand. I mean, what vices are we bringing to what is called Pan-Africanism? So I don't think that it's a strong movement per se. I think once certain things can be tweaked and put in perspective, you know, they've been talking about this sixth region. And, of course, you know, black people in America can't necessarily be a part of a sixth region because we don't have an economy. And I mean, we do have an economy, but we don't have, you know, an economy that, you know, you can dip your hands into. We don't have, you know, the means of operation. And so it's something that's been discussed. It's something that's been, you know, toyed around with. I don't know how serious Africa is really about those of us in the West when it comes down to bringing us into the fold. I know they said that, you know, that was something that Gaddafi, you know, had formulated and put together, you know, before he was murdered. But now that Mugabe is in office, I think that now is a serious time to really assess where we as African people are concerning either Pan-Africanism or African redemption.
Mm. Okay. Another question for you.
Yes, sir.
Well, the average black person will not know what you're talking about when you're talking about Pan-Africanism.
Right.
And, you know, if people don't see nobody, most of these movements are educated. I guess they're educated people. And you can't make no serious moves about nationalism unless you include the small people. I mean,
right.
The average person, you know.
That's
and
right.
I think what happened, Garvey movement appealed to the small guy, the same as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's movement.
Right.
You know,
right.
It,
right.
It was the small guys who made the movement.
That's right.
And I think we've gotten away from that. We've been on the campuses and stuff like that. We've forgotten about the root
right.
of our is on the ground.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I totally agree with you. As an example, you know, and a lot of people don't like it, but you can't dispute it because it's a historical fact. But, you know, black nationalism or Pan-Africanism, if you will, you know, really comes out of the black church experience. When you look at Henry McNeil Turner, you know, he was a bishop in the AME church. And when mm-hmm. he became, prior to him becoming a bishop, it was only a few thousand in the church, and this was started by Richard Allen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But when he came into it and he started with the Voices of Mission, which was their official publication, their organ. The organization grew from I believe 12,000 to 450,000. Literally overnight. And he traveled the breadth of Africa. And he also instituted schools on the continent, one being in South Africa. And so then when you look at Henry Highland Garnett, you know, who was a reverend, a minister, you know, before he died, you know, he wanted to make sure that he got back to Africa so that he could make his transition. And I think once he got back to Liberia within 2 weeks, the man was dead. But he was capable of getting people to look towards Africa, same as Alexander Crummell, you know, another minister. You know, he and Henry Highland Garnett both attended school together at the first African school in New York. You know, some would even consider that to be one of the very first African-centered schools. And this is where these black children, you know, learn more than just, you know, grammar and mathematics and so forth, but who they were as African people. And so this movement, you know, as you put it, you know, the regular people, the people who are on the ground, see, this is why they were able to understand what nationalism really was, because it wasn't something that was apart from the people. It wasn't about, you know, necessarily generating any fancy term to make it sound cute. It was just an everyday thing. It was something that you practiced every day. I mean, some of the first libraries were started in the basements of churches, where
mm-hmm.
people could come and study and learn about morals and character and so forth. And so because we don't have that today, because we distance ourselves from, as you say, the everyday people, you know, we want to wear the Ankh, but, you know, we don't want to, you know, teach about the Ankh, or, you know, we want to wear the big beads or the dashikis or, you know, our hair natural, and basically for people to question us versus us going to the people and relating to the people on the level in which they truly understand.
Right.
You know, do our people have life insurance? If they die today or tomorrow, and that was our people through the church and through other institutions, they became benevolent societies, and they met the people where they were. What was it that the people had? What was it that the people didn't have? And if the people didn't have those particular things, they developed institutions. So whether it was dealing with labor, people who were escaping from the South and running up north, they provided them with not only shelter, but employment as well. And that's something that you do not see in our movement, as whether we call ourselves Pan-Africanists, whether we call ourselves African Redemptionists, black nationalist, and so forth, if you're not meeting the needs of the people, there's no need for the term.
Yeah, I agree. You're either useful or you're useless.
There you go. There you go. You hit it right on the head.
Yeah. Well, I see a lot of the churches have changed. They're not like they used to be. They used to be the center of the movement.
That's right.
And that whole thing changed. So now you have a group of people act like they are afraid or too shy to approach the church.
Right, the mega church syndrome.
Yeah, you gotta make the church participate. That's a part of our history.
Oh yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And so we gotta make it work for us. And that's
And the famous picture that you see Mr. Garvey in his plume and a gentleman sitting right next to him, you know, with a hat on, you know, that's Junius C. Austin. You know, Mr. Garvey considered him the greatest pulpiter or the greatest minister, black minister, in the country at that time. He and that picture, you know, dates back to 1924, and they were both the same age, similar experiences. Junius C. Austin, you know, came out of Virginia, and was a minister there in Pennsylvania, and later on went to Chicago and became a Garveyite. Many of his members were. Bessie Coleman, who was a member of his church, was also a Garveyite. She attended the convention of 1922, I believe it was. Colonel John C. Robinson, you know, who went over to Ethiopia and fought against the Italians, one plane, one man, you know, also, you know, was a black nationalist who attended, you know, Junius C. Austin's church as well. But the only thing that he's credited with is being one of the founders of gospel music. No one ever talks about his nationalist ideology and ideas and so forth, because that's what they wanted to take away from the black church. You know, when we look at, and they closed the school down, you know, down in Georgia, Morris Brown. But Morris Brown was a part of the whole conspiracy with Denmark Vesey. He was the only black man who was capable of escaping, the only black man who was willing and wanted to kill white folk that got a school named after him. And he came out of the AME church.
There's something wrong with that picture. Some words on the internet is that this guy actually was the one who snitched on Denmark.
No, not at all. Not at all. Not at all. He was one of the only ones to escape.
All the other ones were hung.
Oh yes. Mhm.
And he got away.
Yes. Yes, sir.
And he was a nationalist, but they named something after him. Well, I don't know the whole story, so I can't really speak on it. But I'm definitely going to do some research on it.
Indeed.
And sometimes, you know, you hear things on the internet, you have to just investigate it before you.
Well, you know, and that's what I call Google scholarship. You know, we got to go straight to the book.
Mm-hmm.
We got to go straight to the book. And we have to read them in its entirety. And once we get to certain footnotes, we got to go get those books and read those as well.
Right.
You know, the internet has hindered our development as African people, because you see how we pretty much use it. You can go to something on YouTube, and all you got to do is just read the comments, and you see how we attack one another.
Mm-hmm.
Go on Facebook, and you see how we attack each other. You know,
mm-hmm.
based on limited information, limited knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I just call Google scholarship. You know, just because somebody can go to Google Books, it's not the entire book. You got to go through the entire book.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. That's very true. So,
well,
I mean,
I want to bring on the international organizer for the UNIA Incorporated, Brother Muammar Kamal. and I have a question for him. Are you with us, brother?
Yes, sir. On the case for the race. What's happening, bro?
Question I have for you, black man, is what do you think about the people today that fly the red, black, and green, knowing what it means, and call themselves Pan-Africanists?
Well, I absolutely abhor, loathe, and am hating like Satan, is that's what the young people say today, on anybody who used that term, Pan-African flag. That is not a Pan-African flag. Now, the UNIA never came up with an absolute term to describe the flag, but the flag definitely does not represent Pan-African ideals. It's a flag that's, if anything, antithetical to what has been popularly termed as Pan-African. The word Pan-African is really a nondescript term. It changes meanings with whoever uses it. But really, just saying all African doesn't describe your philosophy or your approach or program. It just means all African. It could be a Pan-African homosexual club. You know, anything can be Pan-African. It says nothing about your agenda. What Garvey preached was African nationalism, and the flag represents African nationalism. And a particular brand that he typically used, we refer to it as universal African nationalism. So when I look at the flag, there was a stark difference between the intellectual theorists who called themselves Pan-Africanists at the beginning of the 1920s when Du Bois adopted that term, which was used to identify this group of intellectuals who called themselves Pan-Africanists, who actually are working toward developing an all-African civil rights movement. They were trying to beg the West to treat black people better, and they would be the leaders of it. But they weren't ever mentioning in any way, shape, form, or fashion African nationalism. They had no idea about promoting African nationalism, independence, sovereignty, and all these higher ideals. They were absolutely trying to get a fair deal, just like they were doing in the U.S. They weren't doing anything different in Africa. They were just trying to bring all black people together to beg in unison. But there was never any ounce of African nationalism anywhere in Du Bois or the rest of his talented 10th who came together and put together these fancy $8 million words and make this beautiful conference where they all talked about absolutely nothing. And then in the end, Du Bois wind up stealing the name after they coined it and took it and did the rest of his thing. Most of the people in that group of the early Pan-Africanists were avowed integrationists, if not mulatto, you know, supremacists as well. They weren't the most revolutionary group you ever seen. I'll say that, you know, best about as respectfully as I can say it. But the term Pan-Africanist, it changed over the years when the Nkrumahs and others got on board and tried to make it something other than what it initially was. But with every word, you got to look at not just the term, what it denotes, but also its connotation, its social definition, or its tradition and how it's been used. And if you look at the word African nationalism or universal African nationalism versus Pan-Africanism, there's some stark differences between the two. So, you know, I always let folks know that, again, this is not that kind of flag. And some people don't like that, you know, description, you know, or the separation of terms. But I heard someone mention earlier about Du Bois. Du Bois and I think you mentioned Joel Spingarn. If Du Bois was at the conference, Spingarn was at the conference. Because Du Bois was working for Spingarn. He was Spingarn's boy for probably 20-plus years. That was Spingarn's faithful boy. And I mean that in every disrespectful sense I can mean it. He was an absolute puppet of the Zionist movement. He worked for the U.S. government and was an absolute agent of the U.S. government. W.B. Du Bois I'm referring to. And everything he did, no one knows what he really thought because he only was told what to think after they decided what he was going to think because he didn't think for himself. He thought for them. Everything he did was in, you know, glory to his benefactors, you know. So anyway, Du Bois was not one who I would look at as any kind of leader in any sense for black people ever. You know, he had his own agenda, and white folks wouldn't let him have it, so eventually he got mad and left the country in exile. But he never really, you know, had his own opinion. His opinion was whatever they told him to make. And one example of that is Joel Spingarn during the war in, you know, 1914 and 1918. the boys for most of the year, most of the war, had given his own opinion that blacks should not participate in the war for independence for France, and we don't enjoy the same rights that we're fighting for them and risking our lives for, you know, over here. So he was absolutely dead set against the war until white folks offered him a commission in the War Department and told him he could work for the Negro Subversion Division of the U.S. Military Intelligence. He can actually spy on black people and get paid. So when they offered him that commission, they offered it to him and to Joel Spingarn, and they both decided to get on board and change their whole story around, and all of a sudden they started telling blacks that they need to go out and fight in the war, and this is your country too, and all that kind of nonsense. And he wrote this great article, what was it called? I forgot the name of this silly thing he did. But anyway, he wrote this article that, in fact, it was funny because I was just watching Roots with my daughter the other day, and the guy in the film, Simon Haley, quoted from the article that the boys had wrote on describing why blacks should jump in the war and risk their lives for America when, you know, we were getting beaten and hung and treated like dirt by America, and, you know, the same way we are today. So anyway, Joel Spingarn was the one who was working with the boys back in the 1910s. You see later, you know, he was the one who selected for the Unconscious Negroes the Lift Every Voice and Sing as to be the official anthem for the black race. Yeah, the white Zionist Jew made your anthem for you. So I hope he didn't write it, but he selected it. So, you know, he still called the tune. This is the same Joel Spingarn. This is the one who was a racist Zionist Jew who couldn't stand Marcus Garvey and that flag and everything it stood for, nor the anthem that accompanies the flag. So you have, Du Bois and the Spingarns and the Mary White Ovingtons and all these other clowns and, you know, folks coming together against the Garvey movement, along with the, you know, racist eugenics white folks on other levels. But you got all kinds of people coming out against Garvey, and these were not supportive. You know, these were the Pan-Africanists, people who used that expression. And I don't adopt it at all. I mean, I know people, every now and again, for lack of better words, I might use Pan-African because I know people have used it in the latter days, and they've tried to change the meaning and ascribe a certain meaning to it. And no one can agree, of course, but hey, that's a good effort. I mean, I'm not mad at people for using it. But don't describe that flag, not the Garvey UNIA flag, as some Pan-Africanist flag, and that's a disrespect to the tradition that created it, in my humble opinion. You know, so that's my perspective on the nonsense. Any questions regarding that?
Well, I have one more question before I bring Brother Astro Ross on. What do you think about the person who said that they're a devout Garvey,
phone breaking up?
Yeah, I couldn't hear the question.
I said, what do you think about a person who claims to be a devout follower of Marcus Garvey and a devout follower of Booker T. Washington? Frederick Douglass, and then calls himself a Pan-Africanist. Is that valid? I mean, can you tell people that? Does it even make any sense? That's the question.
It's oil and water. The two don't mix.
Right. As I was saying, I don't know how that person would mean that. I mean, like, there's an expression that we're more than just who we are, or, like, you know, I can be a African. I can also be at the same time biologically a Negro. I can be at the same time a Moor, legally speaking. I could be at the same time a Christian or a father or a husband. I can be a lot of things at one time. So I guess it would depend if you're calling yourself all these things, how do you mean them? Culturally, religiously, politically, philosophically, or what? If you were talking about all philosophically, then yeah, there's no way you can be all those things. But if you were talking about in a political sense, maybe you were supportive of this ideology or oratory, and maybe in a philosophical sense you were supportive of that or something, then I would see how they could come together. But I'd have to get a little more on how that's being used, because otherwise I'd be confused. And the Pan-Africanist, again, I give people a break on it with some things, except for the flag. You know, when it comes to Pan-African, I don't use it. And, you know, I don't try to impose my opinion on others. But when it comes to the flag, don't associate that flag with nothing Pan-African. That I don't play. But anything else, you know, of course the anthem I wouldn't. But anything that's rooted in the Garvey tradition, I don't put with the Pan-Africanist label, because then you confuse people into thinking that he was saying the same thing that Du Bois was saying and some of these other early, false prophets. So you start to confuse people. And I don't want to, you know, I want to always make that clear distinction in the tradition of the UNIA. Certain things we say, like, we're not big on the word diaspora, but we use Africans at home or abroad, or, you know, right, certain other terms that we may use that other people won't use, and it kind of distinguishes a certain brand of nationalism versus what other people may articulate. But yeah, I mean, and the reason I say that about Frederick Douglass is there were a lot of people in the Garvey movement who knew Frederick Douglass personally, you know, like Henrietta Davis. In fact, that was her cousin. We all know that he had some issues, you know, dealing with, you know, his, you know, white woman and, you know, working as an agent for the U.S. government. You know, there's a lot of things that are antithetical to the Garvey's, you know, black nationalist philosophy. So the two absolutely on the philosophical tip can't go together. But if you were some way to say, you know, I don't know, maybe the, you know, the oratory training, I don't know. I mean, I would have to hear the explanation, I guess, in order to see whether that would, you know, fly well. But yeah, philosophically speaking, no, the two can't go together. But Pan-African, I can give somebody somewhat of a pass on the right word if they're describing themselves. They just have to describe to me what that exactly means. You know, if it's going to be a all-African Revolutionary Party kind of Pan-African definition, or is it going to be some other kind of, you know, strange cultural nationalistic definition, or what exactly it means. But African nationalism, that I know. That I clearly know. You know, Garveyite, I definitely know what that means. There's no mistake about that one.
And so it's really an oxymoron to put the two together. It's contradictory, and that people are being fooled with that. So
right. I mean, you have to look at the history of both men. You know, William Lloyd Garrison, who was a white man, you know, who pretty much put Frederick Douglass in a position to speak on the issues related to slavery. This was the same man that had outed him to let people know that he was sleeping with a white woman out of England while she was visiting him here, allegedly helping him with his movement while he was married to a black woman. And this is the first, you know, this is the first time that we hear about him dealing with white women. And so then the last is in the end of his career, you know, 4 years before he makes his transition, you know, he marries a white woman. And so, of course, his children are opposed to the fact that he marries a white woman. So you can't put, you know, a Frederick Douglass with a Marcus Garvey, you know. And, of course, the argument might be, well, you know, the UNIA had rechristened the SS Yarmouth to the SS Frederick Douglass. But, of course, this was something that, and as Brother Morey and I had pointed out, that, you know, sometimes we give a little bit of leeway based on where the people are at that particular time. But it doesn't necessarily mean that we agree with it per se, but you can't put the two together. You just can't.
And I guess, too, kind of is what you were suggesting, too. Frederick Douglass was an abolitionist. That was his contribution to our race. He was a loud voice against slavery. Whether he was perfect in other ways after that, that's another whole story. But he was a loud voice against it. I definitely know of certain altercations he had with Henry Highland Garnett and other people who, right, I would have disagreed vehemently against some things that Frederick Douglass advocated. But he was, you know, I guess if someone does so many things good and so many things bad, you don't want to throw them under the bus all the way. You know, you disagree with some elements of, you know, their personality or behavior or, you know, thinking. But he had some admirable qualities, I would say, But, yeah, philosophically,
well,
there's
a quote that he made, you know, in reference to Martin Delaney, who, you know, at that time, I guess we would say, would have been the closest thing to a Marcus Garvey. And he says, you know, I thank God for making me a man, but Delaney, Martin Delaney, thanks God for making him a black man. And I think he clearly points out, you know, he makes it very clear that he's only fine with being a man, but here's a man on this side. He's proud of his African heritage. He's proud of being black, being African. And that was the difference between the two. And, of course, when we look at Martin Delaney, here's a man who, you know, had gone to Nigeria and, you know, was capable of establishing a treaty and surveying the land with Robert Campbell, who came out of Jamaica. So, clearly, you know, Douglas wanted no part of this nationalist movement. So even the, you know, brand him, if that's what most people consider to be Pan-Africanism, that's something that he was not. And so even associating him with the red, black, and green flag and the anthem and so forth, that's something that, you know, I think we should be clear on that, you know, he would have been opposed to.
Because, see, we're trying to clear up the confusion with this, because there's a whole lot of confusion going on out here now where people misguiding the youth, and they need to know what is what, so take their position, which one they want to stick with. Astro Black, Mike, yours.
Yes, good evening, brothers and sisters. I want to thank the ladies and gentlemen who are on the panel for your wonderful insight and your commentary, and it's a pleasure to have you here, and it's a pleasure to be here. Brother Bartley made very keen observation and commentary about the presence of the church in black liberation and black unity, historically at least. And watching the news and watching the headlines, we're seeing the string of churches throughout the South who are being bombed and burned to the ground by white supremacist terrorists. And the intel has finally come to the surface that all of these churches were targeted. All these churches, historically black churches, were targeted because they were stations on the Underground Railroad. And then so we're seeing now in the 21st century how these colonial oppressive states are building up their war armaments for the new global offense, the new global scrimmage in the first to have in the 21st century, and they're doing it off the backs of our people and our land. And so you look at Africa specifically, that has the land that supplies the nuclear materials for nuclear war, and also the high reserves of fossil fuels. And brothers and sisters on the panel, will you please describe and really convey to our audience the urgency and necessity of self-defense and self-reliance in the 21st century?
Sure. We just recently, and I'm in the state of North Carolina, where, you know, I'm in the South, and there's quite a bit that goes on when Mike Brown, you know, was killed, when he was murdered. We had a situation here where a young boy had been lynched, and the Mike Brown, the Ferguson situation, overshadowed the lynching of this young man, you know, which is several counties over from where I stay. With the church burnings, of course, you know, there will always be copycat crimes. It's just like when, gosh, I can't think of the brother's name, out in Jasper, Texas, when he was murdered. There were several attempts to drag other black men in places like Alabama and Mississippi. The only thing is those brothers were fortunate enough to get away. But we just recently had the reconstruction of black leadership. And with the reconstruction of black leadership, we had workshops. One was done by way of the Siafu Gun Club. And so people had an opportunity to be exposed to weapon training. And then we also had martial art demonstration as well. And so it's highly important. It's imperative. You know, and of course, this is the difference between, you know, as Brother Morey, my point, pointed out, universal African nationalism. If you see the brand in it, what you saw was the African Legion. You know, the Pan-African movement has never produced a legion or army or military of any sort. Everything has always been on paper. And so as nationalists, as African nationalists, you have to come from off of the paper. We have to come off of our blog radio sites. We have to come off of our YouTube. We have to come off of our Facebook. And we have to do the practical work, because it's not about likes. It's about application. It's about deeds. It's about what it is that we do. And so we have to be able to set up, you know, these workshops all over the country, not where we get so caught up into personalities and who's saying what and, you know, who's saying that and who's flying here and who's going there, but what are we doing in our own yard? So we have to learn how to fight where we stand.
That's the truth. And I have Brother B on the line, and me and him have been talking extensively about our people getting together and creating a plebiscite so we can put our people on the right direction towards being free or being more economically unified if they're going to stay in this country. And I want to hear what you guys think about, because the only plebiscite that we can point back to is with the UNIA in 1921 at their convention. What do you think, and how do you think we should go by trying to put a plebiscite out today in order to bring our people together?
Organization. Organization, organization, organization. You know, pretty much like I was saying, you know, earlier about the, the workshop model, you know, clearly the greatest thing that we have to deal with right now is public safety. How do we protect ourselves? You know, every city has a model for public safety. That's what the Black Panther Party, you know, when they were the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, that's what they had instituted, public safety, you know, how to defend ourselves. And that's how you, you know, start to begin to build a plebiscite. You know, just like the early Black churches, you know, they met the people's needs. What are the needs? You know, as we start to deal with the needs, you know, who grocery store are we going to? With all these Black farmers out here, you know, that's something that, you know, at the center, you know, people capable of coming to the center and, you know, getting their food from Black farmers. That's where the support starts. And that's how we build that plebiscite. You know, we don't build it by, talking about those things. We deal with it by way of, you know, who are the people who, you know, have certain services that they're willing to offer.
Exactly. And I've noticed in this new movement that's going on now called the Conscious Movement, which I don't really, you know, ascribe to like that. They have a lot of people who are afraid or scared to go into the church where our people are, into the mosques. Now, I can understand them being afraid going into the mosques, because these Muslims are crazy with this lot of stuff. Yeah, I mean, you have to spoon feed them little by little. But going into the churches and explaining to the preachers and the parishioners and everything that they were in the past the harbinger of the movement. What do you think, and how do you think we should start out trying to get into these churches today to try to influence these ministers? If they're influenceable, if they're not brought out or sold out, how do you think our approach should be? I'm addressing this message to Brother Kamal. He's still with us. Okay, Brother Kamal, are you still with us? You might be new to this phone. Go ahead, Brother Cimarron.
Well, I think, you know, one of the very first things that we have to do, and this is one of the things that we do at the center, is, you know, open invite. You know, we invite these people out. I had one over at the center, you know, and, you know, his background is financial, what is it, financial consultant, financial advisor. And one of the things that we were able to do was put a program together, a workshop for our team, and it was basic banking and basic banking and budgeting workshop for teenagers. And so, you know, you start to build those relationships, and, you know, when they can see that you are actively doing something in the community and not just espousing, you know, your view about the world, but doing things that are positive, doing things that will have some type of impact on the community, you know, you won't have a problem with those. And, of course, those that you do have issues with are the ones who are just trying to fleece people. So,
very
I mean, you know, we can always have good relationships with, you know, whether it be the church, the mosque, temple, you know, whoever. I mean, you know, this thing is about liberation. If people, you know, are comfortable, you know, where they are, I mean, you know, that you had Jews over in Germany who were comfortable. They were comfortable, you know. And as things started to, you know, escalate, you know, they were like the toads in the pot. You know, they just adjusted to the temperature of the pot until they got cooked.
Yeah, I agree with you, Brother Cimarron. In order for us, I think Brother Akbar had mentioned something about the plebiscite. And
yes.
For about 20 years, I've been working with people who are supposed to be about that. One thing that I see that's holding us back is that we have lost the touch with the common people, like I stated earlier.
That's right. That's right.
I think we have to start with what's already organized. I guess we got about 200 or 300 organizations, black organizations alone here in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we have to start reaching out to those people who are already organized. Bring them to the churches or whatever facility we can use. We're going to have to start gathering our people together. And it starts
right.
with where you live at on your block.
That's right.
We got to get
right.
that in our head that it don't start. It don't start in Boston or Baltimore.
There you
it
go.
Starts
that's right.
where you live at on your block.
Right where you are. That's right. That's just like, you know, I step outside of my house and I pretty much know just about all of my neighbors.
Right.
You know? See, you know, as a nationalist, you know, whether someone comes out of church or whether someone comes out of the nationalist movement, we all know somebody who suffers from high blood pressure. So how do we deal with those things? When Hurricane Katrina hit, it was a situation where you had people who were literally dying who didn't have to die because there was someone who had similar medication as them. See, we have to be able to organize around those issues, whether it be health, whether it be public safety, whether it be around education. We're all catching it. So we know somebody who's a diabetic. We know someone who has high blood pressure. We know someone, you know, who are dealing with all of these different ailments. But because within the nationalist community, we want to be so doggone exotic and so different and challenge others on, you know, whether they know the Medunetur or whether Kemet means land of the blacks or the land is black. See, we want to go off into la-la land and not deal with things that are practical, that are on the ground.
But
and
see, that's
where the confusion comes in.
That's been the case, though. Now, I've been in this movement since, 68. All right? And it's the same thing. You know,
right.
we do a lot of talking, but you never see the nationalist people beyond some type of meeting or something that the nationalists have, or if they giving out, if we giving out flyers and stuff, you know what I'm saying?
That's right.
You never really see the real groundwork like you running a campaign. I've analyzed this thing, and if we're going to be successful at getting our people together, we're going to have to run this thing like it's a campaign.
Exactly.
You know what I'm saying? You got to knock on people's doors and get to smiling and shaking hands and being friendly again.
That's right.
We walk around with long faces like the world, like we can beat the world, but don't have two nickels to rub together. You know what I'm saying? So,
there you go. Hey.
You know, so
Dr. Thompson Williams, the way he put it, he said, rejoin the race in a manner in which you were never apart. And that should be the campaign of the race.
That's right. And that's the only way reparations will come into creation in the plebiscite, you see.
Right.
So I believe that somewhere down the line, we black people are going to have to really make some serious decisions.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to have to really be organized to run a plebiscite, because it's no more than a people's vote, a referendum. You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
And there's a history of referendums, but we just haven't reached the stage in our political development that we can implement something like that, because we're too divided and everybody thinks they have the answer to the problem.
Exactly.
But they don't realize they are part of the problem.
That's right.
Go ahead, my brother. Go ahead, Brother Bartley or Brother Astro Rod, because I have to run to the door.
Yeah, like... you know, a lot of these young brothers don't really know what's going on, Brother Cimarron. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. Well, see, you know, with part of what's happening right now, and I call it this YouTube movement,
mm-hmm.
the cult of personality is being built around different individuals and different so-called movements. And
mm-hmm.
it has become very problematic because it has never been about the personality. It's always been about struggle and the liberation of African people. And see, once it becomes about the personality, you know, the people will never be able to win. The people will never be able to win, because once that personality leaves the scene, then, you know, everyone starts to try to pick up pieces and, you know, certain myths are created and folklore and you know, even within the Garvey movement, you know, we see it as well. And this is why you have had so many different offshoots from, you know, the main organ.
Mm-hmm.
Because people wanted it to be what they wanted it to be. Oh, you know, the Garvey movement was just an economic movement, or it was just a religious movement, or it was just a political movement, and people branch out into those particular things. So they take aspects instead of taking the whole and utilizing it so that we can lift ourselves out of the situation that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is part of the reason why we have to, you know, cut that aspect of, you know, cultish behavior, you know, and that's what we see. Again, like I say, that's what we're seeing within this movement, because we've been given a new medium of how to see certain personalities. You don't have to, you know, rip and run around the country like those brothers and sisters used to have to do back then, because now you have YouTube. Anything that you want to hear or see, all you have to do is just upload it.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. You don't have to be in all cities, because everyone can get you in every city, every town, every parish, just by tuning in to something that, you know, someone uploads. But the bottom line is, it's the work. And what we notice is that those who are running around the country are not leaving those areas with people for something for people to do. They're just going to those areas. Just to say that they've been there.
Well, to me, it's a hustle.
It is.
You know, everybody got a hustle going.
That's right.
And hustling in the name of nationalism or whatever you want to say, you know, they hustle.
That's
because
right.
The bottom line is, if we're not taking care of the political, economic, and educational and cultural aspect of our own community, then how can we say that we're going to step out and liberate anything? You see what I'm saying?
Exactly.
And, I find that the whole thing has been twisted.
Right.
The internet can never free anybody. You're still going to need ground. So everything is on the ground. They think that cyberspace is the place, but it's not. You
That's
have
right.
to get out here, like I keep stating. We
That's
have
right.
to get out here and begin to know who our people are, begin to make friends
right.
with our people. And it crosses religious lines, philosophical lines, and all that. I mean, hey. We're all in this together, and that's the way I look at it. You know what I'm saying?
I put it to you this way. Had Harriet Tubman had a Facebook account or a Twitter account, she'd have been captured.
Right.
So, and I say that to say many of our people are just not serious.
No, they just,
they're not serious. You know, it sounds good when, did you see what this one posted? Did you see what that one posted? Did you see how many likes that person got for saying this, that, or the third? But the reality of it is that those who were serious about the work had a certain work ethic. And they would do anything at all costs in order to see our people liberated and free.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think Facebook encourages therapeutic gossiping.
There you go.
It seems like people get to vent and feel like they had their voices heard, and therefore it's over with. You know,
That's
revolution
right.
is over. You know,
That's right.
Like, you know, but nothing comes out of it constructive.
Myself personally, I'm a Facebooker. I think that Facebook could be a wonderful organizing tool if black people weren't so damn scared to stand up. Because the Arabs, they organized. The white folks on March on Wall Street, wherever they had that thing, they organized. But it just seems like black people can't organize for nothing but a party or something.
Right.
Something that has no meaning whatsoever. I mean, all you have to do is say, be there. Many people I invited off the internet. I mean, probably over 1,000 to come to the UNIA. And, you know, they don't come off the internet. They just locked into the internet. And like you said, it's become a therapeutic place to vent yourself and another place for white folks to study you.
That's right.
Yeah, they don't need to send the CIA in our community. All they got to do is pull up all these Facebook accounts.
Oh, yeah. Which they do.
They can and will be used against you.
Yeah. I mean, on a personal note, you know, I had a nephew, you know, he was making, and this was some years back, so Facebook hadn't touched down at that point, but it was just emails. And, you know, he was making $50,000 a year. And, he said he wound up leaving the job because he started falling asleep, you know, just trying to look for different buzzwords. Yeah. So that's how serious this thing is. Like, you know, people are on it, but they don't necessarily know that that so-called big brother is watching.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that thing is like the Matrix sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, you know, sometimes you do feel like you want to strike out, you know what I mean? There's so much happening, a little bit of frustration hit you, so you say, I'm going to go on Facebook and drop something nasty.
Right.
You know, it makes you feel good for a minute, then you realize that you made a fool of yourself.
Right.
Because the people out there don't really give a damn, really. They say they like or dislike, ain't nothing they can do for you anyway.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but
we got past our time, and we can face this up.
You're starting to break up, Akbar.
Say good night to all those who came and participated in this forum, and good night to the people that will listen to this and take this knowledge and do the right thing with it. This has been another episode of Wake Up African People. Good night.
Holla black.